Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As we say each week, this conversation includes you. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. 941-3689 if you call us from Oahu. Use that number. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. The shortage of affordable housing has become the go-to topic in the conversation about everything from countering homelessness to supporting the middle class. And for years, we've heard that we need all levels of housing, including at market rate. Often that brings up the question of the best and highest use of available land. But is there enough land in our island state to build what we need? Tonight, our panel considers that question, whether there is or isn't a shortage of housing land. In our studio tonight, Leo Asuncion is here. He's the acting director of the State Office of Planning, and he's also the manager of the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program. Kevin Carney returns to be with us. He's the vice president of EAH Housing Hawaii. EAH Housing acquires, manages, and develops affordable housing and currently manages over 1,900 units on the islands of Oahu, Maui, and Kauai. Jean Lilly is also here. She's the Hawaii Habitat for Humanity Executive Director. The Hawaii affiliate of the National Organization for Habitat for Humanity has built or rehabbed over 245 homes in the last five years. And University of Hawaii William S. Richardson Law School Professor David Callies also joins us. He teaches and writes about land use, state and local government, and real property. And, of course, you're here, too. And, again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 as we take a look at land use in Hawaii, specifically about what we need to do to be able to build the housing that we are always told we so desperately need. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks,
thank you.
Beth.
Nice to see this great full table in front of me. So I want to go right around it and ask each of you just to give a view of how you're looking at the housing market now, the land market now, what it is that you see that has been perhaps changing in this last year and as we're moving into the next year, what your view of that is. And I'll start with you, Leo.
Sure. Thanks, Beth, for the opportunity. The state, the IGA administration, and particularly our office, we look at the different types of policies and also different types of projects that come through on a statewide basis. But, you know, we do look at what happens here on Oahu as well. And as far as, you know, the question of whether or not we have available land, right? We look at land from kind of like a 30,000-foot level, right? We look at what is already urbanized or at least a state land use district urban classification for Oahu. And we find it's, you know, 27%. It's about 101,000 acres, a little bit more than that, that's already urban, right? With the rest being in split between conservation and agriculture. So if you look at that land, the question for us at the state level and my office is whether or not they are not properly zoned, which is down at the county level, and looking at whether or not you have the proper zoning to provide the housing units across income levels, if you will, or across, you know, different types of housing. So that's how we look at it. And, you know, we feel that there's enough land, at least on Oahu, to meet the demand. I believe DBED came out with a housing demand study, and for Oahu, it was like about 27,000 units. Didn't break it down as far as how many are affordable or market, but roughly about 27 and change, 1,000 more units by 2025. And that's what we're looking at, right? So plugging that into the equation, where are we as far as, you know, proper zoning, entitlements, all of that. At the 30,000-foot level at the state, right, we have the 101,000 acres. We do have a number of big projects that just got reclassified in the past couple of years, been stuck in the court system, but now moving along, and are they properly zoned? And then the timing of which, when those units come up.
All right, we're going to talk more about that as we move through the hour. Kevin Carney.
Yes, and thank you for the opportunity to be here again, Beth Ann. EAH develops affordable rental properties. meaning that we serve those at 60% of the area median income, which for a family of four is $57,500 roughly. And so we really can't afford to pay for land. So when we're looking for properties, we're looking for properties that we can acquire or ground lease from the city or from the state, which is usually via a request for proposal process, whereby we have to compete for that land. And, you know, the greatest demand for housing is at that income level and below. So we have a huge demand for what we do. And, you know, I could fill up a 100-unit property tomorrow if I could open one up, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. It just depends on the location. You know, on Oahu, in general, the demand is very, very good. It tapers off a little bit when you get to the outlying areas, the more rural areas on Oahu. And then you have different markets on each island as well. But by far, the highest demand is on Oahu.
David Callies.
You know, I think, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. I think that Leo has it right on point. There is a fair amount of land classified urban in the state land use district, but you've still got 75% of the land, 75% of the land in the state still classified evenly split between ag and conservation. You know, let's agree that it's a really hard sell, and it should be, to convert conservation land to urban. So that means that most of the reclassification is going to come out of agriculture. So the question really comes down to two, basically. First of all, where is the reclassification going to come from? And if you look at a map, general plan map, even an old one, which hasn't changed that much, you see there's an awful lot of agricultural land left, far more than we need to grow crops. And even if it were to pinch it a bit, one can always import food from the neighbor islands. You can't import housing. So the housing is going to have to come from here, and it's going to have to be built here. So it's an issue of what kind of land and whether the land is infrastructured. We've got lots of land, but not all of it is infrastructured. Now, there's water, sewer, roads, and so forth. The other major question is what kind of housing we're talking about. Are we talking about, you know, 8,000 square feet of lot with a single-family detached house on it, which is the most consumptive of land but the least intensive use of land? Or are we talking about multifamily housing, which doesn't take nearly as much land, and all the way from duplexes and so-called quadriminiums up to high-rise apartments held as condominium units? And that raises the major question of how many folks are going to want to raise kids and a family in anything but single-family detached, which is the dream here as well as just about every other place in the country. So it's a matter of what's going to get reclassified and what kind of housing we're going to build.
All right. More of what we're going to be talking about this hour, and we hope you'll plan to join us again. Our number is 941-3689. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Jean Lilly from Habitat for Humanity.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thank you so much for having me on. Our program is a single-family home program, or has been in the past. And one of the things that we are starting to look at is more multifamily homes and utilizing single-family lots to their capacity for the number of families or the number of individuals we serve. Our challenge has been, of course, land. And in the past and current, our families have to come to us with access to property. That's been one of the biggest boundary or access problems that we've had. So we have done probably 75% of the homes that we've done, especially in the last 5 years, have been on Hawaiian homelands with Native Hawaiian families. And our families are the low income, 80% AMI and below, which means that our cap is that families of four are earning about $65,000 a year. And hopefully our program is a home ownership program, 0% interest mortgage for the cost of the home. And we use volunteer labor to build that home, which keeps the cost down to an affordable amount. So with the no interest loan for 20 or 30 year term, our families will be able to afford to live in their home for less than they would what they would pay in rent or what they have been paying in rent, and we still keep it at 30% of their income level for their monthly home payments. So, but access to land would help us expand our programs. Our neighbor islands have had more success in that than our Oahu affiliates have, and we hope that we can make better use of land that may be available and are already working through the transit-oriented development process and trying to partner with other organizations that would be willing to help us with building more affordable homes for the low-income families.
You're all coming at this from a little bit different perspective, a lot of overlap in what most of you have said. Looking at what we commonly talk about when we have these conversations about affordable housing and just housing in general, do we mythologize a few things too terribly much? Are there things that you think that we should disabuse ourselves of as we look to 2016 and what needs to get done next year, what can possibly get done next year? David, I'll go to you first.
Mythology. You know, I'm not sure that the single-family detached house for even half of that 26,000 units is realistic, and it certainly won't be realistic unless Ho'opili and Koa Ridge go forward. So that and transit-oriented development, development right around transit stops, is extremely unlikely to be single-family detached. So if that's the case, then we need to start thinking about realistically whether everybody is going to be entitled to be promised at some point in their life by government or anyone else a single-family detached house.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because for a long time we've talked and believed in the American dream of home ownership. But what home means has changed a whole lot over the last 10, 20, 30 years especially. And watching the movement back into the core of a city, back into city center areas, being able to see much more density being called for in many plans across the United States, certainly here in Honolulu, that seems to be very much changing what that American dream looks like, making in some cases the suburban areas not necessarily as desirable given traffic, given everything that we have to deal with. Do you see other parts of that dream that we need to really adjust in terms of even the promise that everyone should be a homeowner?
I seriously doubt whether anybody, very many people are voluntarily renting. If that's the implication of one of the implications of your question, Bethann,
interesting, because I mean, hearing there was a piece on Morning Edition this week talking about people who are looking to rent as opposed to buy, and we saw that happen a lot during the recession. And in some cases, you know, people who got caught, either they hadn't purchased something in enough time to be able to get into it, or they had recently sold a home thinking that they were going to get top dollar for it at one point, and then it kind of the bottom of the market just dropped. For whatever circumstances, but looking at the idea of, is home ownership all it's cracked up to be still?
I think most people think it is. And so that coupled with a rethinking of our of the way we get around on this island as well as any other transportation policy, that if the fixed guideway goes where it's eventually supposed to get to, I think that this will affect a lot of development patterns. You know, a lot of people hammer away at the cost and the unlikelihood that huge numbers of people that are currently driving are going to be taking a rapid transit line, train. But what transit lines have done across the United States is reorient development, and I think that's what this one is going to do, so that you're likely to get single-family detached out in Eba. You know, there's still going to be a couple of two or three, four pretty big stops up there. And there's still a lot of vacant land that can be converted from agriculture to urban. In the rest of the line and the rest of urban Honolulu, I don't see a whole lot.
Where? Really, where would you put it?
Exactly. And still keep country. And and not continue to overdevelop the Central Plain and so on and so forth in Mililani. I mean, the land, getting back to first principles, the land is available. We've got loads of vacant land and loads of it in agriculture. But it's a matter of regulation and it's a matter of infrastructure. And now with our important ag lands bill, the difficulty of conversion, which is probably as it ought to be, prime ag land. All of those are policies that we are putting in place in a regulatory fashion, and they have very little to do with whether there's actually vacant land available to build on. There's plenty of vacant land to build on.
All right. If you're just joining us tonight, we're taking a look at housing needs and do we really have the land to be able to meet them? You've just heard what David Calley's had to say. We want to hear what your point of view is, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joining us tonight, David Calley, you just heard him a moment ago. Also, Kevin Carney, the Vice President of EAH Housing Hawaii. Jean Lilly is here, is the Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. And Leo Senshin from the State Office of Planning and Permitting. Thank you for being here, all of you. You just heard what David had to say about that. Now, you know, Leo, I see you nodding your head about all of this in terms of development plans and the idea of the best and highest use of land and where is that housing land going to come from. Obviously, it's not going to be, you know, cut out of – it's going to have to come out of someplace. That question, though, of best and highest use is the one that a lot of people fall back to when they're talking about ag land versus housing. And talking about Ho'opili or Koa Ridge, we've heard that argument for a long time that, you know, those are ag lands and they should stay ag lands. But very clearly, the pressure to develop has been steady and constant. Aside from those places, are there other places on Oahu that you see where housing would be appropriate and where there would be an easier time, put it that way, of being able to create the infrastructure which often frustrates developers who would like to go into certain areas?
Yeah, I think kind of related back to the whole mythology of what we want as far as housing. You know, my thought is, you know, I have friends, you know, I have a condo, basically a townhome. I like the lifestyle. I don't need to rake up a yard, right? I don't need to maintain it, pay some maintenance fees, but all in all, it works for me. And I have a lot of friends likewise, right? They move back into an apartment right in town that's already existing because they like the lifestyle of being close to Chinatown, being close to work, right? They don't have to drive or ride. They can ride their bike or they can just walk to work, ride their moped.
That whole live, work, play idea that we've been talking about for about 10 or so years.
Yeah, so given that, and that's what I think, you know, if we're going to keep the balance, right, keep the country, look at where we can efficiently and effectively use or upgrade infrastructure at the least amount of cost, you're talking about doing it within the urban area, like you said earlier, right? Do we come back in kind of like a urban re-infill, if you will, or a reuse of what's existing, building upwards, looking at, you know, the TOD corridor, right, the rail corridor, and where do we have opportunities there? And that's one of the things we've been working with the city and County of Honolulu, and as well as state agencies that have lands around the rail stations, right, up to, we're looking, there's a standard half a mile radius that we use for planning, but we're actually looking 1 mile away from a station because you can have different types of uses and different type of services that you can provide that the state could provide. And is, you know, in our minds, that's where you're going to do it, right? Because you have at least some infrastructure there. You might need to upgrade the infrastructure, but that's much cheaper than putting in a whole new system, if you will. If you were to, you know, take it out ever, and it's the whole urban sprawl thing, right? But cost of infrastructure to go out that far, right? That's going to be a challenge, right? Either for government and or a private landowner that has to do it.
And what about more towards Central Oahu? Because for a long time, we've talked about the development plan, looking at Central Oahu as being the place where a lot of growth would happen from, you know, the 1970s on.
Yeah, you have, you know, I think my sense is out there, you do have some room. it depends on which ones you're looking at. If you're looking at the Cunia side, right, we do have some prime ag land out there. More than likely, it's going to go into IL and be protected. So kind of like we have the breadbasket there. But if you're looking at, you know, the more towards Mililani corridor, the H2 corridor, you already have core ridge. It's pretty much built up on both sides. You have gullies, but then now you bring in, right, the whole environmental thing and whether or not you can actually build there. So, you know, what we've seen there is in the gullies below core or above core ridge, but below Mililani, Malka, is things like PV farms being, all right, so more the opportune type of uses for development can go in there. But, you know, Central Plain you might have, again, then you need to throw in the equation of whether or not people want to commute. Are we talking about building out Second City in Kapolei so that it's a closer commute for them, Central Plain, or are they still going to come into Honolulu? So that's going to play into any type of developer, be it the state or private, has to think about, right, is the market there?
You bring up a lot of points in terms of trade-offs that people would be willing to make and just generally looking at competing interests for the same bit of land that we have, although we talked earlier in the program that there's a lot of land. Tonight, that's our topic on Town Square, and we want to hear from you, too, as we're always, always being told and talking about the idea that we need to have more housing on Oahu throughout the islands. And where is that land going to come from? What's going to be enough of incentive for a developer to work it, both for maybe market value and also to be able to do something good for the community and create affordable housing? All of that, as we've seen, come into the conversation about the needs of the middle class, the working class, and certainly for those who are, in many cases, shut out of the market entirely and need to have affordable rentals. We're talking about all of that tonight. You're welcome to join the conversation at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Ted calling us from Ala Moana. Aloha, Ted, and thank you for your patience.
Hi, thank you. So I think one of your guests pointed out that there's quite a bit of land out there, and one could debate all night whether or not we need housing or pineapples more. But one point I don't think anybody hit on is the pattern of land ownership. Let's just say if I was a major landowner and owned, say, all of, say, Kakaako, the most profitable thing for me would be to kind of slowly develop it and build luxury housing only. And I wouldn't have to worry about a lot of competition around me because I own all of it. I know in the 60s there was some talk about land reform, but I don't think anything's been discussed in that vein since then. I wonder what your guests think about the pattern of land ownership and how it impacts housing costs on Oahu.
All right. Thanks very much, Ted, and thanks for the call. He's looking at this sort of long view. David, can you give him a bit of an overview of that? Has land ownership changed in ways that you see that impact this conversation of what we should do with land, and do we have enough of it to do the things that we say we need to do, which very often compete with each other?
Bethann, I'm not really sure whether the ownership patterns have changed hugely. There certainly has been some change. The issue probably comes up, in the caller is accurate, that if large landowners hold land off the market, then it increases the value of the land, other things being equal, and it's easier to build and sell arguably expensive housing. But, you know, the reclassification process, to go legal for a minute, is a legislative act at the county level. And the reclassification at the state level, although it's done by contested case hearing, has been described as quasi-legislative. What that means is it doesn't take a petition to change the classification of the land. I'm not advocating it either necessarily or partly, but it would certainly be possible for a lot of land to be, quote, urbanized without a petition from any particular landowner. Thousands of acres at a shot. that would certainly bring a whole lot more urbanized land on the market. Whereas if you're looking for an application for a special permit or something in Kakaako, it's at pretty much at the option of the landowner whether they want to do it. You can't force someone to build, but if they've got an awful lot of land that's urbanized and the real property tax is being paid on urbanized land, you might get a tad bit more land actually developed rather than waiting for a landowner to come in and say, I want to urbanize my land.
But developed in perhaps a particular vein, which is what Ted was suggesting, in terms of being able to pull out of it as many dollars as possible.
Well, if the land use, you know, the Land Use Commission every 5 years is supposed to engage into a general review of the land use district and see if there's enough in urban, enough in ag. You know, I'm now channeling Leo because that's pretty much his Kuleana. If the Land Use Commission should at the next boundary review decide that it's in the best interest of housing and especially single family detached to reclassify 25, 30, 40,000 acres of land on Oahu that isn't smack against an urban area, no one's going to build high rises out there. No one's going to build multifamily. They'll build single family detached or they'll build townhouses. And that's just a matter of economics. So
and also based on what we've seen with Ho'opili and
Koa Ridge.
And Koa Ridge, yeah.
Which, you know, needs to be pointed out is within the urban boundary. It's not just raw ag land. That tends to fall out of the conversation about Ho'opili and Koa Ridge. You got a string of former planning directors that have pointed that out in the newspaper. This was a conscious decision to choose housing over ag.
I want to bring Kevin and also Gene back into the conversation a little bit, because for the two of you looking to serve a very distinct population, all of this may sound quite frustrating. And the fact that you're out competing for the same kind of land for a very different purpose that's not necessarily going to create a return that a development might if it's going for either, you know, middle income or for luxury housing. And also having to look for, in the case I'm thinking of EAH in particular, cooperation or a partner, you know, to be able to create what you've been able to do so far. How do you begin? I mean, you've done this for a long time now. How do you begin to approach where we are right now? Even looking at something like a 25 basis point rise in, you know, that the Fed did on 2 days ago. How are you going to look at that? And is that going to hurt you at all?
Well, any increase in the basis points on interest rates hurts us in the long term. But let me start off by saying that we're not really looking for a return. You know, we don't have stockholders that we need to report to in that regard.
No, I know you don't. But in terms of the competition between of what you're trying to do and what someone else may see is their
right. We run into that a lot. I mean, we cannot compete with someone who wants to build a condo. We just can't do it. You know, our rents are restricted. Based on the financing programs that we use, primarily the low-income housing tax credit program. So we can only pay so much for a mortgage. The other funding comes from the tax credits, like I said, and what we call gap funding or soft money from the home program or whatever, grants and things like that. But let me drill down a little bit about how we meet those levels. Let's talk a little bit about Kakaako. The Hawaii Community Development Authority has rules for the landowners there if they want to build anything in Kakaako. They have to provide 20% of for sale units for a minimum of 5 years and 15% of rental units for a minimum of 15 years, both at up to 140% of the area median income. As I said earlier, the area median income right now in Honolulu is $95,800, so 140% is probably about $140,000. And so the complaints that you read about in the paper are that we HCDA Kakaako is not serving the local community. And so they've listened to that, and they are reevaluating their restrictions there. And they're really looking at the low-income housing tax credit guidelines as part of that process. So that's good news, which means that there would be more rental housing there at lower AMI levels, And that's what we want to see. There should also be more for sale product there at lower AMI levels.
But what about the issue of time? When you talk 5 years and 15 years, that sounds like a blink of an eye.
Well, you know, if we were to have the state give us some land tomorrow, we probably wouldn't open the doors for at least 3.5 to 4 years. And that's just because, okay, we have the land. And then land would have to be zoned, right? And there would have to be a certain amount of infrastructure that's provided with the land. Because infrastructure is a big line item cost when it comes to development, depending on the size of the property, the location, et cetera. But the timing is critical. We have to – there's only so many times of the year we can apply for financing at the tax credit level. Some of that tax credit financing is competitive.
Yeah, but I mean, how long those units are held, though?
When we do a property, depending on the land, that's what it starts with. So if we were to lease land from the city or the state, usually it's a 60 or 65-year ground lease, right? So that right there, that's the term it's going to be. And also when you're applying for tax credits, you go through that process. They typically require 60 or 65 years to keep it affordable.
Gene, this seems to be a little bit more problematic for you because they have to come to you with land already.
Right. Yes. And we would love to say, yeah, if the state brought us land today, we would have a ground lease and we would build condos or a multifamily unit and sell the units to the homeowners for their no interest loans. And we're home ownership, and we feel like that's an option. It's not the only option for low-income families, but it is an option that helps them for the rest of their lives and gets them out of poverty. It gives them an asset to leverage for their own, their future and the future of their families. So we feel like we haven't had any success with the Kaka'ako developers at this point because they just can't make the numbers work, which we totally understand. And we don't use tax credits at this point. We're still new in that market and just starting to look. So at this point, we basically are subject to our own funding and hope to get land in other ways by partnering with other developers or with other land owner types and looking at maybe a community land trust option if we can find a partner that could help us out with that as well.
We're going to take some callers. If you want to join us, 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689 if you're listening to the live stream, or if you call us from the Neighbor Islands, that's the number to use. Going now to Richard calling us from Aiea. Aloha, Richard. Welcome to Town Square. Hi there.
Yeah, I'm curious about land that's already urbanized. As I drive around Honolulu, I see lots of older, low-density housing, like two-story walk-ups and Ely's out in Kroll City. There's just seems to be lots and lots of land that could be redone. And what are the barriers to better use of the urban area?
Okay, good question. I mean, there are lots of them. You drive down Kapi'olani and you see some of those. And I'm watching David Calley's point to Kevin here. What?
I think the biggest issue is infrastructure, and the biggest part of that is sewer infrastructure. It's just not there to increase the density on those properties.
We've been talking about that one for a very, very long time. I think maybe even back to the days of Patsy Mink talking about the sewer needs for Wailea and how that would be growing. That's a big part of it. We've seen what has happened on occasion, and certainly whenever there has been a situation where there's been a bigger dump of that, not just what happened with several years back.
It's a major concern for us
because
we look to a TOD along the rail line as an opportunity for more affordable rental housing. But the big question is there going to be capacity?
And that's been the question, though, for a long time, even before we were talking about TOD. So what do we do with that? Because there are a lot of people who know that it's coming who have been saying, well, it's not sexy. We don't really want to talk about it. But it's utterly necessary. If you're going to be able to have all what you need above ground, you're going to have the infrastructure below.
well, changes need to be made in our budgeting process at the city level to address, you know, the increases in the sewer line. I know the city's been looking at it for quite a while. How they intend to pay for it, I don't know.
And that's the conversation that we've had several different times. As every time we back end into this, we can talk land use all you want. If you don't have infrastructure, there's not much you're going
to
do.
Absolutely true. But I'd like to go back to something that Leo mentioned, and maybe to channel both Kevin and Leo. They can hammer at me if I get it wrong. But they're talking about high-density housing. So we got to go back already to the question of who's going to be building single-family detached. Low-income, affordable housing, workforce housing, chances are that's going to be multifamily. I don't know that Kevin's building a whole lot of single-family detached because it's very expensive. It's been 30, 40 years since anybody has tried to do that, and that person happened to be in my law class after for a little while. So, and you know, Leo's, I accept his lifestyle choices and a lot of his friends. My guess is if you ask the average 20-year-old, great, do you want to raise kids there? The answer is going to be a resounding no. And that may be the myth or the dashed dream. It's going to be very difficult to afford a single-family detached house to raise your kids. And that's largely a European thing. The dual income, no kids that are moving in back into the cities, emphasize no kids. They're going to have the time and the wherewithal to take advantage of what a city has to offer. But I don't think Honolulu is there, and we're the most urbanized of the counties. I just don't think it's gonna happen here. So the stuff that's going to go around the transit stops, TOD, most of that is multifamily. I don't see any single-family detached being planned, maybe the half mile out. So you're back to what kind of housing you're going to have. For affordable housing and the need for it, there are lots of ways of getting at it. Kevin and I agree to disagree on some of the methods that are used to come up with that housing, like mandatory set-asides, which I think are unconstitutional. But that's for another conversation. But the truth of the matter is it depends on what kind of housing you're talking about. And when the average person talks about housing, except for those at the most unfortunate end of the economic ladder, which will just eat shelter and then maybe better shelter, most folks have in mind that single-family detached house. We don't do the white picket fence in Honolulu because that's not very Hawaiian. But everything else is the same. Maybe a Panic's Edge instead. Yeah, whatever. But it's single-family detached.
And that goes back to the whole idea of the myths that we perpetuate and also the dream that may or may not be a reality for a lot of people, or even an accessible reality for a lot of people. Watching how different generations have moved, older generations who had those single family homes and who are now maybe bringing in other family members to do a lot of caregiving. You're seeing a lot of stacking of generations in homes, more in Hawaii than I think in any other state. And in some cases done for really beautiful, wonderful reasons that families want to be together. But certainly the economic necessity is part and parcel of the process.
And may I just add that all you have to do is drive down all the streets in Kaimuki, and you can see one after another of the 1,400 square foot bungalows on a 6,000 foot lot being replaced by a two or three generation house. Those are arguably detached, although there's not much space between the houses, and they're not single family anymore. But that's another norm that we haven't discussed yet that's becoming more and more common.
That's becoming common. Now we have the issue with the city and ADUs and trying to pack into whatever footprints we already have some way of being able to maximize that space. David, as you're looking at it from your perspective in terms of just land use and the fact that you don't have sort of a dog in the fight with all of this, is there something that you think that's missing to this conversation that we keep having about how we're best using land both within Honolulu property, outside of Oahu, and throughout the state?
You know, not really. I'm troubled by how difficult it is again to for folks that are going to be able to build single family detached housing, or any developer to build it and make it anywhere remotely affordable to families that are used to them, or certainly a generation ago could afford them. But the highest and best use of land, that's almost a mantra that depends on who you talk to. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we wouldn't want to have every highest and best. Does that mean economic? You know, highest and best economic, biggest.
Well, I mean, it's an open thing depending upon who you are,
right,
and what it is. If you love ag and you say ag should only be ag land and there should be no housing, that's your highest and best use threshold.
Lots of folks think so. If you are a dedicated conservationist, preservationist, then you'd like to see the state conservation district stay where it is and no development take place on it, and that's 44% of the land area of the state, which, granted, includes mountains and so forth that you can't build on anyway. But highest and best use in legal terms and planning terms usually means the highest and best economic use. And that's the only definition that I'm used to seeing a lot. And I see Leo shaking his head up. And he's a planner with a lot of experience that way, and that's something we agree on. You know, he practices law every once in a while, and I practice planning every once in a while.
Good. And right now we're practicing conversation. And if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight we're considering that question. Do we really have enough land to be able to do what we need to do in Hawaii, to be able to build the kind of housing at all levels that many conversations tell us that we need and many reports have consistently said that we need? And how are we going to manage that? Looking forward a little bit to see what it is that we're willing to do and maybe not willing to do when it comes to housing, and taking a look at where we are now that says for many years perhaps we haven't been willing to do a lot of the things that perhaps we should have done long ago to be able to ensure that we would have more housing today. How is that compounding as we go forward? Going now to Walter calling us from Kaimuki.
Hello.
Hi there, Walter. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, thank you. I'll try to make these two real quick. If you could speak to the demographics coming out of Mililani Town, the older generation, the kids are gone and they don't want to mow the lawn, and a lot of those folks are now moving close to town to be near the hospitals and not have to take care of a single-family home if they don't need to, and then they'll be competing with the first-time owners or renters trying to get out of the house and be on their own. And then if you could also, what is the feasibility of taking the most prime topsoil in the Ewa Plain, just Makai of H1, where Ho'opili, I believe, is going to go in? What is the chance of taking the absolute prime soil and taking it to the Kania Farms rather than pave over it, and then the divot that you create by moving that AAA-rated ag soil, fill it in with lead-rated material like concrete. There's always an abundance of seams of concrete rubble for base as opposed to crushed coral. I'll take the listen to those answers off the line.
All right. Thanks very much, Walter. And again, good questions, and thanks very much for hanging out to be able to ask them. If you have a question, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 is our number. All right, Leo. So he's making some suggestions about take the prime topsoil, move that elsewhere, bring something else and pave over that. That would be okay. That's a different type of an exchange than what we've talked about a lot in terms of taking the land as is in each place, and whether or not there were exchanges for that ag land and other pieces of ag property that would yield ostensibly the same kind of use.
Yeah, I think Walter has some new ideas that, you know, we haven't. Creative, very creative. I'm not a soils expert. You know, whether or not you can just transfer soil from one place to another, you know, moving it from Makai from H1 up to Kunia, for example, those are pretty much rated. My understanding, if I remember the maps correctly, those are pretty much the same types of soil anyway. So it's not like the Kunia one is less productive or you know, less soil rating.
I think he's just saying don't waste it, don't pave over it.
You could do that. I would think so. Certainly we've done it in other areas where we have, when we need the soil, we transport it out and get it developed. I would think you know, I'm picturing up in the Kunir area, right? We're trying to develop from a state level a state ag park, right? Whether or not they could use the soil and then replace it with some other lower quality soil or whatever. But I think it's a creative. Right? I mean, that's about the extent that I could probably talk about that.
As far as his other part of his question regarding sort of generational transference, where you have people who are homeowners and they're aging and now they need to move maybe closer into town, as he was saying, maybe to be nearer to a hospital, and you have single family houses out there. Is that really going to be competing with other developments? Is it really going to get any sense of, not necessarily a price break? I mean, we've watched single family homes, average single family homes, about 800,000 on Oahu, and condos being somewhere around 365, somewhere in there. Just having that older generation moving out and having available inventory, is that going to really make a difference? Does anybody think that's going to make a difference?
I think Walter did make a distinction there that they would be competing with, say, first-time homeowners who are looking for maybe a condo, right, in town. And that's what they can afford. And that's what we've been seeing, too, because the inventory is not there, right? So if I could afford $1 million dollar home, but there's no inventory for another $1 million home, I look downwards, right? I don't look upwards. I always look downwards, and I keep looking downwards where I eventually find maybe a $500,000 home, and I'm okay with that. Now I pocket $500,000 because that's what my old home was worth, but I've actually pushed others downwards, right? Because they have a maximum of what they can afford. So that's where we've been getting some of the arguments of having units across the different income stratas, if you will. And I think that's what Warren was getting to, was how can we prevent that? And it goes back to, do we have enough inventory?
Well, every time we have some inventory that seems to go away at whatever level, you're right, people will look downward because they're not going to go and try to spend more money, particularly if they're first-time homeowners and they're getting into it. They don't have another home where they're pocketing some money. They're just simply not spending that mm-hmm. amount. So looking at the difference between, say, buying a $400,000 or $500,000 townhome and spending $800,000 to get into pretty much a first home situation that may very well be a fixer-upper, there's a big difference in that. And that goes back to that whole issue about pricing out middle class and pricing out the younger generation that will be coming up into that middle class who aren't that, you know, you're not talking about somebody who's like 25 or 30 years old. You're probably talking the 30s to the middle 40s at that point in time. Is there any argument into that, David, that you see with that transference of inventory that we already have and building that out, stacking it maybe perhaps with more generations moving out in that direction than moving older people who have the home into more of the central corridor?
I guess it's possible. You know, the demographic that our caller identified is just the demographic that seems to me is ideal for, once again, transit-oriented developments around our transit stops. These aren't the folks that are going to want to have a single-family detached or anything else out in Eva, or really any other place out in the country. They want to move further in. And the way the transit system looks like it's going to run very close to major shopping centers. It's going to run very close to hospitals. If I were looking 5-6 years down the line to move out from a single-family detached house, and I do own one, I'd be looking for something around a transit stop, and I'd be glad to get rid of a car because I wouldn't need it. Now, I'm a transit junkie, so I mean, what can I tell you? I love trains and the rapid transit systems. But the fact remains that I think the TOD has tremendous potential as urban channeling and growth channeling. much more than solving traffic problems. It's a future thing. And if it's done right, especially if Leo's looking out a mile from the stops, there are just an incredible amount of stuff that the state and the counties can do. They'll own some of the land. If they don't own it, they can condemn it and then write off some of the costs and say, fine, we're gonna put Gene stuff up there. Right, and we're going to give them, and because it's around a transit stop, there'll be infrastructure. There's just a huge potential of solving the housing problem for folks that are under the median income level. Huge potential with TOD, if it's done right. And I see, I have no indication that it won't be. It will just take a little time to get those. We're talking 20 some stations. I mean, that's a lot of 1 mile certain nodes that can accommodate a whole lot of reasonably priced housing without the need for an automobile, or at least one, not two. Or if you go into the multi-generational aprons in front, one, not six.
So what does that mean? I mean, going back to what Walter was asking about, when you have single-family homeowners who are older, who may very well think that sounds like a great dream, move closer in, live around TOD, get rid of the car, be closer to hospitals, all that. Meanwhile, they've got a house out there. Is there really going to be a younger market for that house who will say that it's worth for them to drive in if they could buy a single-family home?
That's a question for somebody like Brubaker, you know, to answer an economic model or someone from UHERO at the university to talk about it, Sumner and LaCroix. I'm not really qualified to do that, although I had a minor in economics. I try to hide that. Eventually, I mean, if there are enough of those folks that move out, and this is not a great, I suppose, something that a lot of people look forward to, that owning a house, but the value of that house is going to fall. It's a matter of supply and demand. If 20,000 single-family elderly homeowners suddenly moved into the kinds of things, some of it that Gene builds, you know, some of it that's just built by Stanford Carr, and moves in, they don't even have to even move closer into the city. They can pick one of the stops that's 15 miles out. You're still going to get in 40 minutes without a car. And be dropped off within walking distance of your hospital or Alamoana Center. It's a tremendous change in attitude. But I think the elderly, to get rid of that, you know, Leo's already there, doesn't want to rake his yard, to get rid of that stuff, I think it's a tremendous idea.
Kevin?
Yeah, I just want to say, you know, one of the purposes of accessory dwelling units is to keep seniors in their homes so that they could build that accessory unit. Maybe move into that smaller unit that's easier to take care of and rent out their house and generate the income they need to hire somebody to mow the lawn. So that's one vehicle. But we see a reluctance of seniors to move out of the urban area to properties that we have further out, like in Eva. And these are not people who own a home, but they've been renting, and the landlord raised their rent, and they may qualify for our property, so their income would be below 60%. And our senior properties, you have to be at least 62. But we have more vacancies on senior properties out of town than we do on senior properties in town. And the reason we hear most is that, no, I don't want to move out there. I want to be closer to my doctor.
And which is exactly what I think Walter said a moment ago, that that looking to be closer in. So then does that property have to be sort of recalculated to deal with a population that needs it? I mean, if you're having some of those units going wanting.
Well, we do build properties specifically for seniors, so yes. But again, we're looking for land in the urban core, so give me a call if you have any.
Or in the corridor. That's the thing. Yes. Once the transit system is up something 15 miles out, and kick me next time I call you Gene. Well, yeah, Kevin,
Well, she's Gene, so.
So what can I say?
But I'm hearing some of the things that we've talked about tonight, the fact that, David, you were saying nobody really wants to get loose of the American dream of home ownership. So trying to find how that works, whether it's a condo townhouse that Leo has or whether if you're able to afford a single family home, that's still very present in the way we look at life. But also given the fact that you're all talking about pulling back into the city core for seniors who want to be closer to maybe a doctor or to other family members, or because it's just easier, or if it's a couple starting out, even maybe a couple with smaller kids and they want to be closer to work, and the whole live, work, play movement that we've seen for the last 10 years, that we're still watching a contraction from the suburban lifestyle back into a very urban lifestyle. And that's pretty consistent with what we've seen throughout the United States for a lot of years.
But it will be, with respect, it'll be linear, not center city, with those places that have a rapid transit system with transit stops. It just changed the face of Washington, D.C., in terms of where you can get to and from. And when WMATA goes out to, you know, Virginia and that distant airport called Dulles, it's going to change even more.
We don't have that kind of sprawl here, and we're coming to the end of the hour.
But we're linear.
No. Linear, yeah, I know we're linear. But looking at this from the initial question that we asked of having enough land, you're all saying in many ways that we do have enough land, but that we're going to have to reprioritize and make some real choices in how we use that land. Not something that we haven't heard before, but do you really see that there's any way of being able to make a real dent? Obviously, catching up to these thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of units that we are behind is going to be really tough. In your case, Gene, people have to come to you with the land already in their pocket so they can have you help them build a house. That's a different situation. For you, Kevin, when you're talking about EAH building rental housing, having to find the appropriate partner and financing, et cetera, and for everybody else who's looking at can they possibly buy a condo like what you're happy to live in, and me too for that matter, and or whether they'll be willing at some point to trade it into a single family home and be happy to be driving in because they're going to be perhaps farther afield than what it is. It all goes back to how are we going to develop this little place? Do you have any thoughts as you look into coming next year that we're going to be able to make any gains?
The best gain that we can make if we step out of this particular subject is to vastly reduce the regulatory regime that adds 10 to 15 years to the development of a greenfield site. One of the reasons Kakaako is so popular is its one-stop shopping, as Kevin said. If you go to Kakaako, if what you're going to do fits their plan, it's one approval. If you go out in the country, you've got to go through the Land Use Commission and get the land classified urban, and then you've got to go to the city and county and start all over again in their land use control system. And after that, you need to think about if you're in the coastal zone, getting a coastal zone management permit, and on and on. Stanford Carr can talk to that and any other developer in town.
And we've talked to him. We've just got a couple more minutes. I want to just go right round. A few words from you, Kevin.
I just wanted to say that unless we want to pave paradise, we have no choice but to redevelop the urban core and increase our densities because there is a huge demand across all income levels and all types of product. So we need to balance that out somehow.
And I think you hit it on the head. I think it's a reprioritization on what we do with our existing urban land and, you know, what comes to the top of mind. So like in this administration, we're already looking at TOD. It's where we want probably affordable housing to go. How can we make that happen?
And for Eugene, left out with someone who has to already have land?
Yeah, well, and us having to rethink the whole thing, too, in terms of our partnerships and so forth, be beyond single families and onto developers and that kind of thing, I think is echoing the same kind of thing, more density as well.
All right. Thanks very much for joining us tonight, to all of you for calling in and for being with us, and to our panel, Leo Sunshin from the Acting Director of the State Office of Planning and also Manager of the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program, Kevin Carney, Vice President of EAH Housing Hawaii, Gene Lilly, who just heard speaking a moment ago, Hawaii Habitat for Humanity's Executive Director, and University of Hawaii William S. Richardson Law School Professor David Calles. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Tonight is our last live show of 2015. Next week being Christmas Eve, the following week being New Year's Eve, we will have special program for you. So I wish you a very, very happy holidays and a prosperous and safe and healthy new year. And I'll see you in it back here in a couple of weeks. Have yourselves a good evening. Aloha.